This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
The European bank Dexia is in big financial trouble,
which could mean trouble here at home.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Adrienne Hill. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Tuesday, October 4th.
Well, coming up, three new trade deals make their way to Congress.
Know the foreclosure robo-signing debacle?
Oh, yeah.
Turns out Fannie Mae did, too, way before the rest of us.
And later, the falling price of oil.
Those stories and more on the Marketplace Midday Update.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Vast Conference, conference calls that give you clarity, professionalism, and flexibility all at a low price. For two Vast Conference calls free with no commitment, go to vastconference.com, promo code Marketplace.
The European bank Dexia is in big financial trouble following concerns over exposure to European and Greek debt. But French and Belgian finance ministers said today their countries will guarantee financing for the bank. Now, the Dexia fallout could affect cities and towns right here in the United States. The BBC's Andrew Walker is with us now from London with more on that story. Hi, Andrew.
Hello there.
What's the link between this particular bank and all these cities across the United States?
Dexia has a long history of being involved in the market for American municipal borrowing. It's something it's trying to run down, but it is still involved. And it is involved in a particular type of borrowing, providing guarantees for debts that are kind of remarketed almost on a weekly basis. So the interest rate can change over very short periods. And as the worries have grown about Dexia's stability, so the interest rate that some American cities are having to pay on this debt has risen quite markedly in the last few months.
It's gone up. Well, how much trouble is Dexia in, Andrew?
Quite a lot. I mean, there are real worries, partly because it's very dependent on raising money in the short term in financial markets. That market is under severe strain because lenders are worried about the strength of European banks. And Dexia has got a particular problem because it has a very large exposure to the debts of some of those Eurozone governments that are in such trouble, particularly Greece, but it's also got a big holding of bonds of Italy, Spain, and some others.
The BBC's Andrew Walker in London. Andrew, thanks.
My pleasure.
Oil prices dipped below $76 a barrel today, the lowest level in more than a year. For more, we turn to Julie Niemann, an analyst at Smith Moore & Company in St. Louis. Good morning, Julie.
Morning, Adrienne.
So what's going on with gas prices?
Well, gasoline today nationally is averaging about $3.41 a gallon. That's a 25-cent drop over the last couple of weeks. And here in St. Louis last night, I paid $2.98 a gallon. High excitement there. But gasoline is actually priced off of Brent crude, which is a little under $100 a barrel today. Look for Brent to continue to fall, though, and lower prices are coming to a station near you very shortly.
Why is that?
Well, a couple of reasons. First is the recession. It's still continuing on. We have no real recovery, and high prices have already hurt a really injured consumer. We use less. We can't afford joyriding. Even our kids aren't driving as much. And OPEC wants to keep the prices high, so they'll try and cut production. And by the way, Big Oil loves this because OPEC does all their dirty work for them. They can continue to produce at full tilt. But we have a good supply of oil, just not much demand. And secondly, it's the shoulder season. Now, spring, you have no driving and even less heat. In the summer, high driving, no heating. Winter, you have a lot of heating. And we're in the fall here, where you have less driving and still not heating. So when you get to the shoulder seasons, prices come down anyway. So that's the only cheery news I have for you this morning.
All right. Julie Niemann is an analyst at Smith Moore & Company in St. Louis. Thanks so much.
You bet.
Well, the White House has sent three big trade deals to Congress, agreements with Colombia, Panama, and South Korea. And those bills have been delayed for years now because of politics and partisan wrangling. Rebecca Blank is acting Secretary of Commerce, and she's with us now to talk about that legislation from Washington, D.C. Madam Secretary, welcome to Marketplace.
Good to be here, Steve.
Why are these trade deals so important?
These trade deals open up other markets to U.S. companies and help create jobs for American workers, work towards the administration's goal of doubling exports over these next 5 years.
But these deals have been on the table for a while, right, in the Congress? So what's been the holdup?
These deals have been discussed for many years, and the president was concerned that they were not completely in the right configuration and went back and renegotiated, so that you now have broad spread bipartisan support with both the automobile workers, for instance, supporting the South Korean free trade agreement, as well as a good number of Republicans.
What do you say to people who believe free trade has been a disaster to American jobs? I mean, looking at NAFTA and the jobs it sent to Mexico.
I mean, I think that's a misunderstanding of what the effects of these trade agreements have been historically. The U.S. has a very open economy, and foreign companies have widespread access to the U.S. economy. We need equal access to the economies of other countries.
I want to shift gears for a moment and talk about this debate over a proposed bill that would try to compensate for China undervaluing the yuan. It would impose duties on Chinese goods imported here to the United States. How else would the U.S. battle an undervalued China currency?
We have been pressing them for changes. Indeed, you have seen over the last 2 years very steady increases in the value of the Chinese currency relative to the U.S. dollar. So the degree of undervaluation is much less now than it was 2 years ago, in part in response to U.S. actions. That said, there is currently a bill in the Senate that is quite a broad-based bill in terms of the sort of penalties it would suggest imposing. We're in conversations with the Senate about that, as to whether that's the right approach or whether there are other things we should be doing.
The Chinese are using words like trade wars, perhaps. I mean, are you guys concerned about that?
I think you always have to be concerned that you do not want to create trade wars with other major economies. You know, I would certainly hope that we're going to find a resolution and a way to deal with some of our concerns about Chinese currencies without anything that approaches something we'd call a trade war.
Acting Commerce Secretary Rebecca Blank, thank you so much, ma'am.
Thank you.
Today, Ford Motor Company announced a deal on a new 4-year contract with the United Auto Workers. It trades annual pay raises for profit sharing.
Sprint is betting big on the iPhone. The Wall Street Journal is reporting today the cell company has promised to buy more than 30 million of those phones over the next 4 years. Sprint has 33 million customers on contract-based plans.
So it's planning to move a lot of those people to the iPhone.
Everyone gets an iPhone at Sprint. Wow.
More numbers on our website at marketplace.org.
And get the podcast while you're there as well. And comment on the podcast, too. If you check it out, if you download it, tell us what you think of it.
You can also follow us on Twitter at Marketplace Radio. I'm at Adrian Hill. That's with one N.
And I'm at Radio Chio with one
Chio.
R.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Vast Conference, the service that gives clarity, professionalism, and flexibility for conference calls at a low price. Vast provides both regular and toll-free numbers so you can set up calls anytime and provides web tools to manage or record calls instantly. Priced at 2.5 cents per minute with no commitments or contracts, try Vast Conference with 2 free calls at vastconference.com, promo code Marketplace. That's vastconference.com, promo code Marketplace.
So, Steve, remember last year when we all started talking about foreclosure abuse?
Yeah, things like robo-signing, where these thousands of foreclosures were done like within a day without legal review?
Exactly. Well, it turns out Fannie Mae and its federal regulator knew all about that. That's according to a new report out today from the Inspector General. Joining us now is Gregory Warner. Good morning, Gregory.
Good morning.
So tell me about Dexia.
So Dexia is a Belgian bank, and they're running out of cash. They own a lot of Greek debt, a lot of Italian and Spanish debt. Those are obviously not good bets right now. Dexia also extends credit lines to American cities. So if a city needs to raise cash, they issue a bond. Dexia guarantees those bonds.
So what's the fallout for those American cities doing business with Dexia?
Well, I called Paul Simon at Tactical Allocation Group. He says many American cities have found a new bank to guarantee their bonds, but cities that are still stuck with Dexia, and there are a number of them, could suddenly have a lot less cash. American investors would get hurt as those municipal bonds lose value, and even the possibility of a restructuring for Dexia prompts a deeper worry.
Confidence, a lack thereof, and we believe Dexia is just the warm-up act because there have been distress signals in the short-term funding markets in Europe for a while now.
Now, if that rises to the level of what he calls a crisis of confidence, we could see other banks following Dexia into that trouble zone.
Marketplace's Gregory Warner, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke appears before a congressional committee today, and he's going to defend his latest strategy to lower long-term interest rates. Now, the bank wants to spark lending, economic growth, and ideally, they want to spark job creation. Marketplace Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports economists are mixed on whether the Fed is trying to do too much.
Unlike all other central banks, the Federal Reserve has a dual mandate to fight inflation and unemployment. Bank of America economist Mickey Levy says trying to hit both targets raises unrealistic expectations.
Everybody always thinks the Fed can pull a rabbit out of a hat, so the Fed's always under pressure to do more. And many of the factors that are inhibiting economic growth are beyond the scope of the Fed's monetary policy.
Things like weak consumer demand and falling home prices. But others say the Fed is right to do all it can to generate jobs. David Blanchflower used to be a voting member of the Bank of England.
The focus right now on unemployment and growth is really central. Down the road, we don't have a problem with inflation. Inflation's going to fall.
Blanchflower says the European Central Bank made a mistake earlier this year when it raised interest rates to fight inflation. Now he says they have to backtrack. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Markets are closed in China this week for a national holiday, and people are traveling by subway and train. But there's concern in the country over rail safety after some bad crashes in the last few months. Marketplace China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports.
Shanghai subways are running slower this week. It's a safety measure the government's carried out to avoid another accident. He Guoying is one rider who still feels a little nervous.
The government needs to be more careful. If they put the lives of the people first, then we wouldn't be seeing so many accidents.
She repeats a phrase that's popular these days in China. Things are moving too fast. With all these accidents, many wonder whether the quality of China's new infrastructure could possibly equal the quantity. A new morbid Chinese phrase has even risen out of this. Dai Xue GDP. Blood-soaked GDP, the idea that China's risked people's lives in its quest for rapid economic growth. Subway rider Cao Xuying says her options are limited. I have to take the subway, she says. Too many people have cars these days, and driving in Shanghai traffic would get me nowhere. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
And Steve, you know all those coffee breaks we take around here?
Coffee breaks? What are those?
You walked up to Starbucks half an hour ago.
Busted.
I know. Well, it turns out all those trips add up. According to Forbes, a new study from the office supply store Staples finds snack and coffee breaks take up 2.4 billion hours of work time each year.
Wow.
Now, sure, all those trips to Starbucks mean people aren't at their desks, but I have to say I'm way more productive with a cup of coffee and me than without.
And some caffeine, too.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. At 2 o'clock in the morning, you betcha. As we've heard, President Obama's got a couple of economic plans that he's touting. Of course, we mentioned the trade deals with Colombia, Panama, and South Korea. And then, of course, the near $500 billion jobs package, the American Jobs Act that he's calling it. The president's been more forceful lately on the campaign trail for the most part. He's been going to different places across the country. And that's a change from what critics say was too conciliatory a tone with his political opponents. But journalist Ron Suskind charges in his new book, Confidence Man, Mr. Obama was even too conciliatory with his own economic team in the midst of the financial crisis. Ron Suskind, welcome to Marketplace.
Nice to be here.
I want to talk about one of the things you allege in the book, that President Obama asked his Treasury Secretary, Tim Geithner, to put together this breakup plan for Citibank. Too big to fail, right? So we've got to break this thing up. Why didn't that happen?
The president was trying to sort of summon his Rooseveltian moment just a few months into his term. He felt these big banks needed to be taken down. The overhang of toxic assets was causing fear. You know, Tim Geithner was not in favor of this. He actually was kind of the lone man standing on it. Even Larry Summers, who tends to ally himself with Geithner on the first do no harm principle.
This was the National Economic Council director, right, Larry Summers?
That's right. Chief economic advisor. He was even with the president on this. But Geithner held his ground and didn't really pull together the plan the president wanted. The president now says, I think forcefully, that those days are over. He has the team he needs. He's the more forceful president, having evolved.
Larry Summers is quoted as saying, we're home alone. There's no adult in charge. Was that, in other words, saying President Obama didn't have a grasp of what was going on in his own White House?
Larry Summers responds to the home alone riff, saying that, look, we had five times as many problems. We didn't have five times as many people. It was a time of crisis. This home alone riff by Summers ends up, as is often the way with Summers, becoming kind of a framing issue where people do fear rightly that there is no one in charge that can control these unwieldy forces in this global economy that's buffeting the United States.
The debt ceiling debate is where this book ends. And, of course, the president's push for job creation, the American Jobs Act. Is the president more engaged and more knowledgeable about what's going on?
There's no doubt he's more knowledgeable as to his acuity and knowledge of economics. Now, having said that, when you look at the jobs package, it tends to be mostly off-the-shelf stuff. I think some people were disappointed. And I think that even now people are saying, what more have you got in the toolkit? The president, for instance, was very, very strongly in favor of a financial transaction tax. There are policies like that, things the president wanted to do, that I think now he might unveil again to say, well, let's do it now.
Ron Suskind, author of Confidence Men. Ron, thank you.
My pleasure.
If you follow the news, you've probably found yourself wondering recently, what is going on with our government? And it can be really easy to point fingers. According to a new book by Harvard professor Lawrence Lessig, the problem isn't as much about individuals acting badly as it is about the far-reaching role of money in Washington. Lessig is the author of the book Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Professor Lessig, good morning.
Good morning.
So what is the role that money plays in government today?
I think its primary role is not the historical form of corruption, the kind of quid pro quo, Rob Blagojevich kind of corruption. I think that corruption's gone. I think the role it plays now is a kind of in plain sight corruption. I work very hard in the book to insist I don't think these members of Congress are evil. They come to Washington for the right reasons, wanting to do something that's good from their perspective. But then they find themselves inside a system which is constantly bending them in a direction that at certain moments in their life they wake up and say, this is not who I wanted to be. This is not the job I wanted to undertake. We need to build a system where people have a reason to trust the system. And right now, as 75% of Americans believe, money buys results in Congress. And that's the corrupting attitude that I think this Congress faces.
Have we as a country learned our lesson from the 2008 financial crisis?
No. The financial crisis should have produced a pretty radical change, but an extraordinary number of lobbyists invaded Washington and succeeded in blocking any of the fundamental reforms that were needed, so that we are just as unsafe in our financial system today as we were before 2008. And that is a direct product of a government that can't be independent enough to change regulations of Wall Street because they are so deeply dependent upon funding from Wall Street banks and Wall Street hedge funds that make it so that they can't do the right thing.
Lawrence Lessig is the author of the new book, Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Professor Lessig, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Oktoberfest wrapped up yesterday in the city of Munich, Germany.
München.
München, Munich. You say München, I say Munich. Over the years, it has become a big tourist attraction for all kinds of visitors. Last year, the Oktoberfest Bicentennial produced a record amount of beer consumption.
But a report out last month predicted Oktoberfest inflation,
sounds
if you can
bad.
Believe it. Yeah, based on the cost of transportation, a couple of liters of beer, and a half a grilled chicken. All of those prices on the rise. One economist said that Oktoberfest patrons paid more than 3% more this year than they have in years past.
So we wanted to know what that price increase meant to this year's festival. So we have Heather Wynn, the manager of Discover Munich with Lenny's Bike Tour on the phone. Hi, Heather.
Hello.
So can you briefly tell us what exactly the beer bike tour is?
Yes,
I can
absolutely.
Only imagine people drinking beer and biking. That
sounds
doesn't
dangerous.
Sound safe. Yeah.
Well, we have two tours, actually. We have one where we do put people on regular beach cruiser, California beach cruiser bikes.
That's awesome.
We take them out for 3.5 hours around Munich, take them for an hour break at the Chinese Tower in the English Garden, which is the second largest beer garden in the world, seats about 9,500 people.
Wow.
We let them drink a liter of beer there, and then against our better judgment, we do strap them back onto the bikes, but we bring some Velcro and some tape, make sure they stay
on
there.
Are you serious?
Right,
you
back.
Velcro people onto bikes?
No, not really.
And that bubble wrap, they wrap them up in bubble
really?
Wrap too, Steve.
Yeah, basically. It makes sure they get back safe.
Idiot proof is what we call that. So.
And then we've got our other tour, which is the beer bike tour, which is actually rather hard to explain. I would recommend for anyone that doesn't know what a beer bike is to check it out on our website, beerbikemunich.com. It's actually built on the frame of a van, and we have 5 people on each side who pedal the bike forward, 1 driver who does not drink. So it seats 15 people altogether, 10 pedal, and then 5 lucky people get to sit back and relax and just drink the beer. Everyone drinks.
Yeah, that's where I want to be in the back. Please, put me there. And it's good to know there's a DB, you know, designated biker.
Yeah,
yes, absolutely, man. Absolutely. As long as you're not steering, you're allowed to drink as much as you want.
Do you, Heather, get a lot more business this time of year? I mean, are the tourists pretty hard to handle?
They can be when
really?
They show up drunk.
Yeah, because we know that's not a
definitely,
problem.
Oktoberfest is definitely our busy time.
And how different are profits from year to year? Is that something where you notice a big swing?
I mean, we've actually noticed a decrease this year. We don't seem to have as many people. And as you said, the prices this year rose a lot during Oktoberfest. So a lot of people really couldn't afford anything besides the Oktoberfest. So all of the tour companies saw a drop in numbers this year.
But there were more people drinking and more people, I think, what was it, more beer consumption at Oktoberfest this year in Munich, München?
Yeah, the number of visitors went up to almost 7 million this year,
yeah.
And about 7.5 million liters of beer were consumed this year.
But otherwise, not so much business for the rest of you folks over there.
Exactly.
Do people come no matter what? I mean, did you get any pushback from customers complaining about the high prices?
Yeah, we had a lot of people mentioning that, you know, they really couldn't afford to do anything but the Oktoberfest this year.
So
they just had to walk
themselves.
And you noticed
it with the hostels. We work with a lot of different hostels. You had a lot more people going for cheaper accommodations. So instead of staying in hostels, they would stay in campgrounds. A lot of people basically building campgrounds in their backyards and
wow.
offering it to people. So people were looking for, they weren't going to give up the beer.
they wanted to go for the experience.
Anywhere else.
They just didn't want to spend a whole lot of extra money.
Exactly.
Heather Wynn from Discover Munich and Lenny's Bike Tour. Heather, thanks.
Thanks, Heather.
You're welcome. Thanks.
And finally, after drinking all that beer, let's go back to high school, Adrian.
Yay!
So you remember high school? It's so awesome. Pinckney Community High School near Ann Arbor, Michigan has a new homecoming queen, okay? Senior Brianna Amott was crowned with the tiara just minutes before she kicked the winning field goal in a big rivalry game.
Hold on, back that one up for a sec. So
we're rewinding.
Lots of schools have homecoming queens.
Yes, they do.
Lots of those homecoming queens crowning happening during football games.
Yes, they do.
But you're saying the same person
yeah.
who won the football game is is the homecoming queen.
That's actually was crowned. They put the tiara on her with her football uniform on, with the pads and the jersey, everything.
I love it.
Because she plays for the team, for the Pinckney High School football team. She's actually part of the main squad there, the first, I don't want to call her a girl because she's 18 years old, the first woman to do so. Anna Mott tells the New York Times she's excited about all the attention. She did a lengthy interview with the Times. And you know, I was thinking about this when I was thinking about putting the story on the radio, and I thought, what, man, this really, it's not really a marketplace story, but it's a great story.
But it's such a good story.
You brought it. You're the one that brought it to my attention this morning,
Adrian.
Yeah. And I was like, this is such an awesome story. So I'm thinking, what's the economic angle to the story? And I found it.
Please,
yes.
Share.
She is the treasurer at the school.
So a kicker, homecoming queen, and a treasurer.
She's a treasurer.
A very accomplished young woman.
Absolutely. She's going to be counting all the money she makes kicking footballs.
I'm Adrian Hill in Los Angeles.
I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for listening. Enjoy your Tuesday. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.